Hello and welcome to the Films You'd Forgotten, You've Forgotten, the podcast with me, your host, Adam Richmond, and my cohort in remembering things not so well, Mr. Joe Devine.
I've forgotten.
This is the podcast in which we chew over the films we'd forgotten we'd seen in the first place. On today's episode, we are covering the 2011 romantic romance, The Adjustment Bureau, written and directed by George Nolfi, starring Matt Damon, Emily Blunt, Anthony Mackie, and Terrence Stamp. that felt like that sentence was going to lead somewhere, but that's a full stop. Joe.
Yeah.
Oh, do you know what? Do you know what I haven't done?
What's that?
I haven't read a synopsis of the bloody film.
Oh yeah, tell us what the film is.
Okay, let me just get up the.
What about? I reckon I could do a good one.
No, you couldn't. Let's not get silliness.
Okay. I've got an idea for a new game though, but maybe we could talk about it another time. We'd have to try it now. But blind synopsis is how close is it to the real synopsis? That's quite a good game for the future.
Okay, let's give me your synopsis and then I'll give you Letterboxd synopsis.
My synopsis would be and by synopsis, do we mean a kind of sort of like a trailer that doesn't give too much away, or do we mean like what actually happens in the film?
No, we're talking super short, almost
super short.
Like, so this does not even have doesn't have character names.
Fine,
but it really.
So I would say then. A successful American politician meets a woman in a bathroom, falls madly in love with her, but then is hastened. I know they wouldn't have said hastened, yeah. But is hastened upon his journey to bed this woman by a series of sort of strange men in hats.
Right, okay, this is too specific. You're just describing scenes. Okay, try again next time. Here we go. Okay.
Tell me what I should have said.
Here's the synopsis. Here's what you should have said. Fight for your fate. A man glimpses the future fate has planned for him and chooses to fight for his own destiny. Battling the powerful Adjustment Bureau across, under, and through the streets of New York, he risks his destined greatness to be with the only woman he's ever loved.
Yeah.
Okay, that is a nice synopsis without getting bogged down in bathrooms, which is just a scene at the beginning of the film.
I would go and see mine, though. They've made it sound really boring. I like the one where he meets the woman in the bathroom.
Shall we?
And then the men with hats arrive. Like, I'd go and see that film.
The men with hats do not arrive in the bathroom. But do you know, should we talk about, before we, because I think we've introduced a new thread to this podcast, yeah. Was also looking at the trailer to kind of almost remember how the film was pitched.
Oh, shit. I forgot to watch the trailer.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
I'll watch it now. Hold on.
Yeah, just pause it and you watch it now and I'll just twiddle my thumbs.
Now, let me ask you a question. Did you watch the trailer that was 3 minutes long or 2.5 minutes long?
They're basically, I'm pretty sure they're the same. Go for the 2.5 minutes.
Okay.
I've watched both because I do my homework, unlike some people.
I've watched the trailer.
Oh, that took ages, man. Two and a half minutes is too long to sit with myself. So I remember that this is how the film was sold. They sold it as an action film.
They include a scene of Anthony Mackie being hit by a car at the very crescendo of the trailer, which is an extremely unimportant scene that occurs much earlier on in the film. A scene in which Anthony Mackie is chasing Matt Damon. Matt Damon doesn't even know he's being chased. He's just on a bus.
I know, you know, I've brought up trailers, but you talk about Anthony Mackie and you talk about that moment in the trailer. I feel like now, this is massively on topic. We have to talk about the short story that it's based on, the Philip K. Dick short story, which is called Adjustment Team. No Bureau.
Yeah.
It was written in 1954. It was published in 1954 in Orbit magazine, I believe. Philip K. Dick would reflect on his career and say, I think everything he wrote before The Man in the High Castle, he was on amphetamines. And if you read adjustment team. It's a horribly written short story. A lot of his stories are horribly written, but they've got a great idea. This doesn't even have a good idea in it. Adjustment team is tell me, Joe, who is the Anthony
dog? It's the dog.
Anthony Mackie's character in the short story is a dog. It's a dog. Yes. Okay, so there's something quite charmingly stupid about the short story in that it's told from the point of view of a kind of a bureaucratic. One of these bureaucratic men in hats, and
there's hat man.
There we go. They've got an adjustment going on, and they work with dogs,
or they work with summoners. It's unclear whether all the summoners are dogs, but yes, this one does work with a dog. And I thought at the beginning, I sort of thought, is the man doing a voice in his head back to himself? The dog is talking. Okay, yeah, and the dog is a sleepy, lazy dog. Whose only responsibility is to bark once at 8:15 a.m.
Yeah.
And fucks that up.
But it's kind of, I don't know, fun. The whole story is about a man who basically sees behind the fabric of reality.
Yeah.
And that's what...
Something he's not supposed to see.
And then it's all very, very silly.
Can I just tell you, though, I really like any time a dog is in it or is talking, I'm on board. And also, I like other things I liked about the short story were the rationale with which this man who'd seen behind the fabric of the universe and his wife, upon telling his wife what had happened, both sort of had an extremely logical, rational conversation about it.
Yeah, she
where
says
they agreed that he must be having a psychotic episode, but it seemed as though they were saying it with no emotion at all.
That's the bit I wrote down. He says, "I know what you're thinking." That I've had a psychotic break. Why would you jump to that conclusion? If you read this short story, would you think
this could be a Hollywood movie?
Yeah, there is a seed of an idea there, but I mean,
it's buried very deep. Also, if I was a Hollywood movie maker and I read this short story, even if I did think this could be a film, I can 100% guarantee you that I wouldn't think, but what I should do is change the title to include a word that no one can spell so that they can't share it with each other in messages and emails or whatever.
Like maybe even like a kind of a word that was originally maybe French and has kind of been anglicized and taken on into the language, but not really, you know. It's kind of also means, it means more than one thing as well. It means a kind of a side table. So the
does it the adjustment side table?
Get my cigarettes. They're on the bureau over there.
Yeah, I like it. I like it. There's the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Perhaps they think Americans can spell it more, or maybe they included. I guess that's what they would have done. They would have said bureau because they wanted to. They would want to summon the sort of feeling of the FBI, right?
I quite like the title. I don't want to be
The title's good. I like it too. I'm not that whether I or you or I like it does not qualify it to be a good title for a Hollywood film.
But it evokes the things it wants to evoke in that it's this idea of bureaucracy. It's part of the word bureaucracy,
which is present among the angels. I mean, but you know, some of the sort of, I suppose some of the kind of dry humour to be found in the film is that here we have these angels who appear to be sort of relatively all-powerful, who can seemingly predict what any human is going to do or say next, that they have a sort of every human has a, you know, predestined destiny, and therefore all the angels have say over that. And yet there's all this weird bureaucracy, the idea that, you know, God and their structure would be draped in as much red tape as the NHS, let's say.
Well, let's wind back. You've jumped to the word that I wrote down. This film is about ruddy angels. We talked about men in hats. I think the listener is really going to have to do a lot of legwork to keep up with our fast moving ideas.
Sure.
I'd forgotten that this film was, I definitely had forgotten this film was about angels. In fact, I don't think I even clocked it. I must have clocked it at the time, but I've just,
I mean, you I, would I've, have done because they basically say it in the film.
We've been called many things.
Yeah. Chairman. Thanks for being so fucking cloaked about that bit. And also, thanks for giving me so much unnecessary information about other bits. I have got issues with these elements, but I'll come to them when you summon me. Hopefully, not a minute too late.
Let's. I think, you know, we're going great guns at the minute, but let's maybe slow down a bit because let's talk about some things we do like.
Yeah. Okay.
Let's not just this is a wet paper bag of a film. It's gonna just fall to pieces. You know?
Sure.
So let's.
What do we like?
Well, Emily Blunt is always a delight to be in. She's so underwritten and barely in the film, and then she just gets dragged around by Matt Damon at the end, and it's just it's a real shame. I was really hoping, and I don't remember there being a twist, and I was watching it. I was hoping the twist would be, it's not about him and his important life. The reason why they can't be together is because she is going to achieve something important and he's going to ruin it.
Her dance is going to change the world.
What? Yeah, I mean, that would be the pathetic thing, because unfortunately they've made her a dancer, so of course she can't really have any value in life because she's an artist. Who cares?
Yeah, exactly.
But that is used against him. It's like, oh, if you stay out of her life, she'll achieve greatness. She'll change the world of modern dance. And then they swiftly move on. But seriously,
can I say, by the way, just to interject here, I watched this with my wife, and just after that, they say, and if you stay in her life, she'll end up teaching 6-year-olds how to dance. And my wife gasped at the idea that that would be such a bad thing. My wife is a primary school teacher teaching predominantly children between the ages of 4 and 6. She was furious at that point. Go on.
But that point, the film then, if the film revisits that, and at the end of the film you see her teaching 6-year-olds and she has joy in her life, then the film has come full circle. But it's dropped, it's used again, it's said to Matt Damon. Her story is told to him, and what he'll the effect, and it's all him, and it's like, you're going to change the world, you're going to be this important politician. And Jesus Christ, man, I mean, it's reaching for this notion, the idea that the film should be about, like, the choice between doing something great or living a happy life. I think that's an interesting story to be told.
Yeah,
that story is not in this film.
There are lines in many other films.
There is a line of dialogue that kind of evokes that idea, and I want that film. I want to watch that film. I don't want to watch this film. I don't care about this Hollywood version of politics. It's even his second in command is a guy who is in, I think he's in the Kevin Spacey one. He's the fixer in House of Cards.
He's quite a good character in that TV show.
He's a great actor. He's Johnny Politician, and that's who he does that role. Maybe the casting director saw him in that and was like, yes, please, pop him in Cards. But yeah, this idea of this liberal Hollywood idea of, you know, maybe there's going to be this young buck who could really shake things up in the political world.
John Stewart likes him, so you know he's a good politician and not one of the bad ones.
I don't know. It's embarrassing. I feel embarrassed for them because, I mean, obviously we're both left-leaning guys, and it speaks to my, you would love that kind of person to be in politics, but it's such a fantasy. People talk about the West Wing being a fantasy, but it's, I mean, this is what you see this in movies done time and again.
It's a liberal wet dream, yeah.
You know, oh, finally he gives the speech where he says what he's on his mind and he kind of pulls back the curtain. It's like, I saw this in Brewster's Millions.
Well, also, you know, the unspoken element of this as well in the liberal wet dream, manifesto made film, is that all that it takes is for the politician to pull back the curtain. The reality is, the reason the politician does what the politician does is because the people don't respond that way. That the film takes it for granted, for Red, that if a politician were to stand on a stage and talk about how there's 56 different ties chosen for him and then they pick the best one, that the crowd would all go, oh, he's really authentic. There's a moment in this film when Emily Blunt takes Matt Damon to some sort of, like, I don't know, casual adults outdoor nightclub. And they dance around and he's drinking beer out of a bottle like an American man would. And there's all these people who appear to be completely sober and of voting age and voting. So there's already your first black mark coming up to him and saying, hey, man, I voted for you. And he's like, how are you? Because that's how politicians respond to people. And Megan and I, my wife, we watched this and I said, I paused the film to make a grandiose point. I like to do that when I'm in control of the controller. I paused the film and I turned to my wife and I said, do you remember last year there was a video of Michael Gove doing a dance in a nightclub? And people ridiculed him, right? People tore Michael Gove to shreds for doing what the filmmakers say in this film would be a thing that would make a politician authentic and accessible and normalize them, right? This has literally happened, and it does not go the way you think because people do not respond the way that Hollywood film writers think that people do, as if all that the world's ever needed is one guy to think maybe I should not tell a lie and then everything's fixed. It's actually irritates me to see that stuff.
But do you know what? It occurs to me now, it's this liberal wet dream, but now I'm remembering the film I just rewatched a couple of days ago. There is not one mention of what his fucking politics are.
No. Keep the politics out of the film, Adam. You wouldn't want to upset anyone while you're enacting a liberal wet dream in case it turns out that, no, they don't like that at all.
I can't believe I'm only realising that now. He doesn't want to talk about, I don't know, redistribution of wealth, healthcare. You just take the... I mean, I guess maybe you're kind of assuming, because it's Matt Damon and you know the actor's politics, you're bringing that to it. But yeah, there's a real...
John Stewart likes him. So that's the only indicator that he is a Democrat. And it's the only thing that might, cause a Republican watching that film to think, well, perhaps this politician wouldn't be for me. But John Stewart has lots of hearty discussions with people of the right as well as people of the left. So it's not actually a clear marker. But yeah, I mean, you know, the irony of the film being that this guy is authentic and tells it how it is, except the fact that, as you say, the film gives nothing away about what he thinks, nothing away about the state of politics. And it's entirely irrelevant. And also it's the idea that, that he will ascend to... Can I tell you now something else that really irritated me along these lines in this film? I know I haven't said anything good yet. I will say some good things later. But there is a moment in Terrence Stamp, when he arrives in the film about halfway through and they realise they're done with Anthony Mackie and everyone else.
He's a man in the hat.
He's like a top dog man in the hat. He's like the guy you call when something's really gone wrong.
They
call him the hammer because he comes and hammers out situations. I don't know. Anyway, Terrence Stamp arrives with his sort of... His incredible intimidation techniques to try to get Matt Damon to leave Emily Blunt alone. And one of the things he reveals to Matt Damon is that it wasn't always this way. The chairperson once thought that we could hand over control of what happens, of people's own destiny to them, in the form of free will. And we would just help them along the way in order to do that. The first time we did that, he says, humans gave us the Dark Ages. And then for 400 years this happened. So we took control again and we gave humans the Renaissance and we built humans back up and then we gave them control again in 1910 and humans gave us, you know, what happened. And I watched that and thought, like, this film is like, it's impossibly like Western-centric. The idea that nothing bad happened between the Renaissance and 1910 is frankly like one of the most offensive ideas I've ever heard in a film. It means that the writers of this film, or the character, really want to say it's the character,
the writer
of the film, appears to equate, or at least appears to suggest that the European-focused wars, the world wars, right, which of course happen around the world, but mostly happen in Europe, are worse than slavery, which took place, right, for many centuries before the Renaissance, but, you know, throughout the period from the Renaissance all the way up until this 1910 period, that is happening. And they're in charge during that point. It's like, you couldn't possibly be more... Is it just America's guard? Is that what it is? Like, that frustrated me so much because it's not difficult. And within the context of the way in which Terrence Stamp says it, he is saying, it's good when we're in charge, it's bad when you're in charge.
It's a speech that explains the film. And when you hear it, you're like, ooh... He's saying things like, they're very evocative, like the Dark Ages, the Renaissance. These are things that my simple mind can latch onto. And it's like, oh yeah, let's boil down humanity into binary things.
Into the top page of Google results.
And explain why we would need overseers, angel overseers, to nudge us in the right direction. But, you know, as soon as... So, who built this? The whole thing is annoying because it's the chairman. It's a film about Christian God and free will, and for that reason, I'm out.
Well, it's also bureaucratic, and they have capacity issues. There's something that the Anthony Mackie character, who's also a man in a hat, tells Matt Damon early on. Well, we can't follow everyone all the time because there's capacity issues. Well, why do you have capacity issues? You appear to be able to do whatever you want at any time. You've got all magic. You've made everything. Why don't you get more of you?
We can't read your mind. So, okay, the writer's going to make arbitrary rules to kind of justify why... At certain points in the film, they can do some things, and at other points, they can't. It kind of really is... The whole thing is just justifying the big sequence at the end where Matt Damon is running through doors, and that's it. Okay,
that's it.
It's like, this film is a short film. It's a music video. It's a music video idea, and then... 2-3 minute music video, probably a Talking head song, let's say... Talking Heads song played over. You know, what's that one?
This must be the place.
Whenever the days go by.
That's a different one. What's that one?
I don't know. I don't like Talking Heads. I don't not like them. I like that one and, you know, Psycho Killer, but, you know, the hits. That's the song, man, that plays over that, and that's a great music video.
Thing I liked about it, you've just reminded me, with the very, very much the same aesthetic, and actually this ties with things I remembered about the film. I also forgot that this was an angel thing. I forgot about that bit because it's a weak premise and it's very, very stupid. But what I did remember was the men in hats, and I remembered it with, what's the painting with the man with the apple face?
Oh, I know the painting, but I don't know.
No. So just this film has always
Let's make us sound even thicker by you bringing up a very famous...
The painting.
By bringing up a famous painting and neither of us knowing the artist.
But of course we do know that it's attached to the Thomas Crown Affair. Pierce Brosnan one. And these two films have been connected in my mind for that aesthetic reason, because they've obviously gone for the aesthetic of the man in the hat with the apple face, whatever. I like how kind of grey blue it is. I like that they're wearing bowler hats. I think that's quite fun.
They're not bowler hats,
you
but
know, whatever they are, you know, hats.
But imagine how cool it would have been if they'd all had like floating apple heads.
I would have preferred it if they'd had apples in front of their faces. Although Anthony Mackie, I really like Anthony Mackie. I think Anthony Mackie's one of the top guys out there. I don't know. He's got a warm, appealing face. I like him. I would believe him. You know,
it's very dismissed quite quickly, where he's been watching him for his whole life, and he basically has watched and or been responsible for Matt Damon's brother's suicide, drug suicide, and dad's death. Matt Damon gets over that very, very quickly.
He does. There's a lot of dead people.
And then he says, what about my mum? And he's like, oh, yeah, that one's an accident.
Okay, nothing to do with that. Yeah.
Fine. Yeah. Okay, mum was an accident. Fine. You were around for dad and brother. All right, also fine. This film is a romance. Let's talk about it as a romance, a romantic romance. Okay. This film is a film for your mum.
For my mum?
For one's mum.
For one's mum.
And, you know, that might sound, does that sound misogynist? I just think, you know, their taste, mum's taste. Okay, I don't...
Well, this film is a film for romantic people.
I saw a romantic film recently called Decision to Leave, a new one from Park Chan-wook. And it's very romantic, but it's bleak, and it's about unrequited, suffocating. You love someone, they don't love you, and kind of being close, but being very, very far. And then when you suddenly don't love them anymore, that's when they're interested in you. And that's romance. Well,
they don't make romances like they used to, do they? They don't make nice romances that you could just enjoy, the fantasy romances, the liberal wet dream romance. That's what I want. I want where there's no stakes and where I don't have to...
sarcasm.
I swear every time I sit down to watch a film, I'm sort of being half serious. I sit down to watch a film now and then the film goes, here's the human stakes. Here's what it would be like, really. I go, I fucking know what it would be like, really. I've sat down to watch a film so I don't have to deal with this exact thing. I want the liberal wet dream fantasy romance, Adam.
But so you want what this film served up?
Because not this film.
But this is
I didn't want this one.
This is the fantasy of there's quite an interesting idea. Again, there's a couple of interesting things here. They keep finding each other and you're thinking, God, this is stupid coincidental bullshit. And then there's a very throwaway line where they're like, oh, we've been rewriting the... When we rewrote the plan, they were always originally, in the original plans that the chairman, aka God, had, they were in love. But then God rewrote the plan, so then split them apart, and then again he'd rewrite. And so they've technically... The Adjustment Bureau has adjusted time... so many times that sometimes it changes reality, but so there are kind of echoes of life as it did happen before it was adjusted, where these two schmucks fell in love, and that's why they keep finding each other. That's a nice romantic comedy.
You've successfully explained it better than the film did.
Great, okay. I feel good about myself. I understand story.
Yes. If they'd explained it like that in the film, I would have felt better about it, because it made me feel like I was watching a film with computers in, where the writer doesn't know anything about computers and they've gone, there's some code that's got stuck in the doorway of the of the machine log. And even though I know that the Adjustment Bureau is not a real system, it still felt like a writer didn't understand the real system and was trying to describe it in a ham-fisted hacker way. And it's like, there's no rules here, man. The system isn't real. You can say whatever you want. It doesn't need to be like, you know, the Matrix thing has become confused in the neural network.
I mean, that's the thing. The writer and director, same guy, is totally in control. He can make the rules whatever he wants. And he's decided to make them arbitrarily impenetrable and kind of wishy-washy. But unfortunately, it's lumbering under, like it's got a splash of the bureaucratic silliness of a Gilliam with a kind of fantastical angel type nonsense of a Wim Wenders, with some running through the streets a la Jason Bourne.
He does, can I say, that is my favourite bit of the film. There's a bit when Matt Damon's character decides, well, fuck these hat guys, I'm going to chase this woman anyway. Because already in the film, they've made the rule where they say, listen, if you tell anyone about us, we're going to erase you. you're going to erase your you forever and you'll be gone.
A threat and they so he doesn't ever a threat they never deliver on.
No. So that's quite a good threat because he doesn't tell anyone that he's frightened of that. But then they say this other thing. They go, and hey, also, by the way, don't go and see that woman again. But if you do, we won't erase you for that. We just really don't want you to. And so then, obviously, all the stakes for the thing he doesn't need to do, none of the stakes for the thing they also really don't want him to do because it keeps causing them so much trouble. So there's this thing where he's, I guess he kind of realizes this and he's like, well, hey, fuck you guys. I'm going to go anyway. And he runs down the road to try and get a taxi because they're blocking all of his cabs. And the taxi driver goes, okay, hey, I'll stop for you, and gets hit by another car. There's an accident. But the moment just before that, before the accident, Matt Damon hunches his shoulders over and he runs like a rugby player would do in the film Invictus, or he runs like Jason Bourne would do in the film Jason Bourne, or whatever that's called. And it's like, this is a democratic, presumably a democratic politician, someone running for senator in New York. He doesn't run like that, you know? No one's told Matt Damon, hey, Matt Damon, don't run like a stunt guy, you know, run like a politician would run. Run with your shoulders back up, you know, run in a way that wouldn't make you more aerodynamic, or like you're, you know, charging someone down in a war, or like you've just finished filming The Great Wall, or whatever, you know. Just run like a normal guy. But Matt Damon can't help himself. He's always running like that. If you look, watch any Matt Damon film, he runs at least once in every film, and he always runs like that. And it always makes me laugh.
It's important because he doesn't want to look silly.
And yet he does. Well, okay, well, this brings me to my main analysis of the film. Would you like to hear that?
I'd love to hear your summary.
Okay, here's my summary analysis.
Okay.
My summary analysis is this. Whether it means to or not, and I'm certain that it doesn't mean to, Adam, it falls into the category of most American films. It's quite late to the party, but pretty much every American film since, you know, 1945... has fallen some way or not into this category. And that is the category of a critique on communism. That's what American films are a lot of the time. This is a massive generalization and obviously not true, but just go with me anyway. This film is unintentionally a critique on communism. I believe it to be an unexamined example of that. This is an example. So, for example, you think about how internet trends grow, where someone does a TikTok and it's really successful for some reason. Maybe the music was correct, or there was the right sort of amount of comedy in the cadence of the TikTok video. And then what happens is, because it's so successful, everybody else does that as well. It sort of sweeps across the internet, and you've got all these creators who they do all these things. And it works really well, but they don't really think about why. Great example of this would be TV that, you know, before Game of Thrones, before HBO really adopted it, and before Netflix sort of started to experiment with form a bit, every straight-to-digital TV show was made in a structure which perfectly suited traditional forms of broadcasting. And by which I mean, if it was a kind of comedy, it was 22 minutes long or 21 minutes long, and it had all these perfect little ad breaks in it. It did all of these things that were entirely unnecessary for the form it was in. They were learned behaviours from people who were not examining what they were doing and were just picking stuff up from what had come before.
Well, no, hang on. You're saying that the rise of streamers, they were writing shows using the same sort of structural beats that had existed for when...
For ad breaks.
For ad breaks, even though there were no ad breaks. So it would hit those... they were paying mind to a structure that no longer was required.
Yeah.
Can you podcasts give me an example?
Make a show that was 20, 23 minutes long or whatever for commercial radio purposes when, you know, before someone starts doing a 3-hour show or whatever. My point is that people, it takes a while for someone to realize, hey, we can do whatever we want here. Mm. We don't need to just do the thing, the learned behavior. And I think that's what this film is. I think this film
What's the Rosetta Stone film that they're all, you know, copying off? Is it just general culture?
Yeah, it's general culture, and it's an amalgamation of all the Rosetta Stones. You know, any time that something was done for the first time and was extremely successful and then was done again and again and again, it's five of those different things all put into one. I'm not an expert on the history of film, and I couldn't tell you what those films were. I'm sure you could say what the most influential ones were.
Well, I mean, for this, though, let's unpick what those films... I mean, it's The Matrix.
The Matrix is one of them, but I'm talking more specifically about tone, right? You already nailed one of the things, like the idea that a person has to choose between in most cases it would be family or like whatever represents love and the furthering of their own individual goals, and most of the time, you know, in Hollywood films they always pick the family because the nuclear family, that's always the thing you're supposed to do. You stick with the family, and that's the kind of like, that's the value, the sort of, you know, the value that is put upon these films by the culture that they're created within. In this one, the whole film centers around the idea that the Adjustment Bureau have a plan that is written for them that they work to. That is quite literally the name of what the Soviets called the way that they structure society. They had plans, you know, in the fucking 80s. This is what they drafted Gorbachev in to try to salvage. And in fact, like, I've been watching the most recent Adam Curtis documentary series on BBC, talked all about this. It's quite fun to have been watching it coincidentally around the same time. But in this situation, like, there's a line within this film where Anthony Mackie's character tells Matt Damon, when he says, "Well, why do they want me to keep away from? Why don't they want me to be with Emily Blunt?" And Anthony Mackie says, "Because Elise is enough for you. If you stay with Elise, she's enough for you, and you no longer have the need to do these other things that they want of you. You don't have the drive to become the president and change the world." And in this situation with Matt Damon, you know, that's the representation of his individual desire. That is therefore placed above the desire of the collective or the collective requirement. Like, this film is about someone in a system where they're being told what to do, where they're being given instruction by a central bureau, by a plan that is not created by them, where their destiny is preordained for them to take back control and to follow their own individual desire and break free of the shackles of the communist regime.
You see, you're not wrong, but I think it's not as didactic as that. It's too thick to be that didactic. And when I was reading around the film, George Nolfi, the director, said, you know, this film is, I'm asking questions. Okay, so these are questions. He wants people to walk out and he wants the boyfriend and girlfriend to say, "Oh, would you give up me to be president?" And, you know, what's more important, love or career? You know, it's these kinds of broad, thick conversations that you want to walk. You kind of, they would last from maybe the foyer of the cinema to the car. And then you're like, all right, sure, this is COD philosophy for idiots. So
I've abandoned my boy.
Yeah, that's what I, you know, that's what you really want to talk about. Yeah. Would you adopt a boy and pretend he was your son?
You've hit the nail on the head there. Oh, and okay. I just want to add something to that as well, because my wife, font of wisdom as she is, said two things to me at the end of this film. The first thing she said is, "Why can't they just have both? Like, what's the problem?"
Yeah.
Which struck me. It sort of struck me when she said that. I was like, that is true. And also, presumably, like, you've already kind of touched upon this as well. But the second thing that she alluded to was the idea that, as you suggested earlier in this podcast, wouldn't it have been better if it was Emily Blunt that had the thing, right? Like, as far as I'm aware, within the culture that I currently live in, the people that are more often being asked to choose between two things are women.
Oh,
women,
mate,
women of childbearing.
Talking about nails and heads, you've... Oh,
a combination of the two of us. We've really splat this one straight into the plank. And as someone who feels very comfortable speaking for all women, and I think they would appreciate that, I would say if there are people within society, as I said, who are being asked to make that very decision, it's not me, right? I'm able to marry. I continue my career. Yeah. I, hey, sailing, I'm like stonks, you know? I have it all.
Yeah.
So really, this film... Again, kind of, I feel like I've shit all over it, and I'm sorry for the writer director. I would hate it if someone did this to something that I worked on. So I am actually sorry, and obviously I'm aware that I'm bringing a lot of stuff to it.
No.
I couldn't do something this good.
Shush. You've really struck on the most.
The mother load.
The mother load there with the I'm going to use the word arrogant. The arrogance that the person who has to make a choice is a man, and he's never. We don't have to make that choice, and we never have done. But the film suggests, I think now thinking about it quite offensively, that if he stays with this woman. She'll get in his head. She'll make him a soft, crazy,
bloody, little baby boy.
Oh, you're gonna. Oh, she's wild. Yeah. Oh, she'll bloody. You know. Oh, bloody women, eh? Oh, wives.
You won't get to be the president, the most manliest of jobs.
They will nag you to a nub, and they'll just rob you of all important thing you want to do.
Yeah.
You will cease to be a human being, and you'll just be a fucking blob on a couch. Yeah. She'll be shoveling in dinner, and you'll be having, and then you'll be squirting out little childlike blobs.
Yeah. And by the way, this is why we don't hire them at the fucking bureau, because all they do is sit around the office all day and chat shit, and they don't act. They're like the dogs in the story missing the summit.
So the short story, right, was published in... I've said this before, but...
Say it again. People have short memories.
They published it in Orbit magazine, and it was the September-October edition in 1954. Do you know what happened, just after that, in November 1954?
9/11.
No, honestly, like this is crazy. It's going to blow your mind. Like, okay. So this is like, we're talking turning points. Yeah.
1954,
November.
We're deep in the Cold War.
It's going to blow your mind. Yeah.
What is happened? It? Why do I feel like you're tricking me?
Well, I'll just tell you. The first Burger King opened.
Oh, really?
Does that not just blow your mind?
I think that must be connected.
I mean, come on. What's going on there?
Like, yeah, that's a really funny joke. I think you need to explain to people what the joke is. I already preempted the joke, really.
You did.
You didn't actually get me.
Preempted slash ruined.
Because I don't love you, you could never hurt me.
You really... I wish you'd just gone with that. You really fucked it up. We'll just cut that in the end. But
no, don't cut. Why is your instinct just to cut?
I just want to cut.
Bits.
I don't want anyone.
No.
I don't want people to
good bits.
Listen, I don't want people to see me. I don't want people to see
me for connecting a film's release, The Life of Pi, I believe, the book's release with 9/11 as a significant cultural touchstone, turning point. And it was very, very well done. Very well done indeed.
Thanks. Maybe that'll run and run.
I hope so. I hope we can always find... That's quite good though, isn't it? We've got a few new games now. We've got the How Close Is the Synopsis game. We've got the Budget game. We've got What Was the Trailer Doing game. Yeah. We haven't played this today, but we can play another time, like Recast the Film game. We haven't done that today, but we'll do it another time. And now we've also got the What Cultural Event Will Blow Your Mind That Was Close to the Release of This Film game. Soon enough, this is just going to be a game show. Should we play one of those games now? The budget game?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think this film works for the recasting game.
I don't think it does, no.
So we can skip that one. But yeah, let's do the budget game.
Okay, well, estimated budget, please.
It's a lot of location work. There's some special effects. I think a serious amount of money was spent on this. You've got
It's expensive to film in New York, presumably, if you're going to close a street or something.
You know, they end up in Yankee Stadium, I don't know, one of those. And
Ellis Island.
So I'd say it's at least 100. Is it at least 100? That's a lot to be spending on a film like this. I'm going to say $100 million.
Well, I'm going to shock you.
Are you going to say 50?
It's $50,200,000 is the estimated budget of the box office for this film.
I tell you what, they spent every nickel of that.
They really did, you know. Perhaps that's where we can give, what's his name? George Nolfi. George Nolfi some credit, because to make a film that looks like this with $50 million, pretty impressive.
Well, yeah, then I'm going to kind of backtrack on it because there aren't actually that many action sequences.
And no,
it
is don't cripple down on Nolfi.
But it is...
We're just building back up with Nolfi.
It's just one sequence. It's one bit of special effects. And otherwise, it's a very...
Two car crashes. There's two separate car crashes. That's expensive.
Yeah, but there's not actually that many special effects. I'm going to climb down and I've really misplayed that game.
What about that hat budget, though? All that money they must have spent on those hats that they got out of the hat bin. Okay, opening weekend, US and Canada. Now, bear in mind, this is March the 6th, 2011.
March Madness.
This is just opening weekend, US and Canada. Have a little guess for me.
12.
It's 21. You're off on this one. Your budget box office game attachment is not doing well.
It makes half its budget.
So this is where we should be talking about the trailer. The trailer makes it seem like an exciting thriller. It's 2011. Matt Damon is at the peak of his ability to get bums on seats, presumably. And this has got Emily Blunt in too. And it's got all these men in hats. You know, there's the scene in the trailer about halfway through where it's all, you know, where the record scratch would be if it was a comedy film. You can see that the man in the hat is standing over the bed. You know, it's quite exciting, isn't it? I can see that being exciting for people.
Yeah, imagine how disappointed you'd be. And I don't even need to imagine. I remember how disappointed I was.
Well, indeed, could this therefore be reflected in the gross worldwide?
Well, if it's made 50 and it's 20, sorry, half in its opening weekend.
Pretty much.
I think it would have done... Damon's going to do boffo box office all over the... You know, that's going to spread.
Uh-huh.
So I'll probably say, probably close to my budget, what I thought the budget would be, maybe 120, 130.
Oh, there you go, 130. I'll take that as a second guess. It's 127, 869, 379. You're on the money for that. But only, let's be clear and fair, only after you... this is your worst performance.
Let's be clean and fair. Yeah, all right, sometimes...
Normally, I'm extremely impressed by your ability to guess in this game accurately.
Yeah,
but you were off the mark today.
Yeah, and I don't mind that, but you don't have to rub it in.
And you thought 1 hour 46 was 146 minutes.
Yeah, okay. And you also thought that this was like a big slam against communism.
Yeah,
you know, we're all fucking idiots.
Yeah.
You don't know the painter of the guy with the fucking apple face. You know,
who was that guy?
I mean, I'm not going to tell you. You'll kick yourself when you find
apple
out the answer.
Face painter apple guy. Face. I've actually put apple face painter guy. Oh, René Magritte.
Yeah, the old Magritte.
I was reading a commentary that Magritte himself actually wrote about this painting. And in this commentary, he discusses, first of all, the main aspect here, the surrealist aspect of this painting, is that the apple... It hides the face, at least partially. We have the apparent face of this individual. We have the apple. The face is somewhat visible. So we have the apple hiding the visible, yet at the same time it is also hidden. It's the face of the person, both visible and hidden at the same time. It's something that happens constantly, Magritte believed, where everything we see hides another thing, something else. And we always want to see what's hidden by what we see. And Magritte truly believed, as did many of the surrealists, that this fundamental principle of human nature was going to be, or needed to be, one of the driving forces in art. The interest in seeing what is hidden or what is blocked by the visible is a very intense feeling. It's a sort of human conflict, Magritte believed, that one might say between the visible that is hidden
So this is the part of the podcast where we take it in turns to read out film titles, and the other person has to remember if they've forgotten the film. And if they've forgotten the film, then that's the next episode.
That's correct.
Okay, so it's my turn. Now remember, you don't have to say the name of the film back to me or say the film. You can reminisce about it a bit, but you know, just you don't have to repeat.
Yeah.
The Lovely Bones.
I haven't seen that one.
The Nice Guys.
I haven't forgotten that because I think it was born on Netflix and it's lived there forever.
Yeah. Hercules, starring The Rock.
Oh, I actually watched that very recently.
Devil.
I don't know what that is.
Smoking Aces.
I have not forgotten about that film.
I have. If you'd said that to me, we'd be doing that, my friend.
Would you? Really? Okay.
And now I haven't forgotten it, though, because I've brought it up. Daylight.
I don't think I've seen that.
Sylvester Stallone in a tunnel. Hacksaw Ridge.
Oh, no.
Oh, mate, I can't believe...
For sake, Adam.
I really don't want you to have forgotten this film. I do not want us to do Hacksaw Ridge. I've got such a long list of films.
I hated that film. And I actually have forgot. I managed to forget it.
I'm really actually... Do you know what? It's quite good. I'm glad I got you on that.
I'm going to climb back up that hill and save all those poor boys over and over again because I believe in God.
You know
Fuck
what?
Fuck off.
Yeah, I really don't want to do that film. Can we carry on? We're not doing it.
All right. Can we break the rules?
Yeah, we're not doing that.
I don't think I can watch that again. It's so self-indulgent. Go on.
Horrible. Apocalypto.
I've actually never seen it.
Okay, fair enough. Better than the Hacksaw Ridge, but forgettable.
Can we get one by every 10 episodes or something? That's good, isn't it? Like, we can get one veto.
Yeah, you've got... Yeah, well, I think... Yeah, I don't want to watch that film. I kind of threw that in there for a bit of fun, but...
Sure.
Really almost backfired on me. Stoker.
What, is that Bram Stoker's Dracula?
No, you haven't seen it.
I don't know, then.
Hannah.
I also haven't seen that. I know what it is, but I haven't seen it.
Carnage.
Oh, that's the one with the four-piece. I also never watched that.
Side Effects.
Is that... That's not Sideways...
I tell you what, this podcast should be called I've Never Seen That or I've Never Heard of That.
That would be a simpler premise, wouldn't it?
The Cell?
Yeah, I've never heard of The Cell.
The Fan?
Don't know what that is. This is going to become increasingly difficult for you, isn't it?
No, I'm enjoying this. I love just saying film names.
Okay.
Ed TV?
Nope.
Cemetery Junction?
Well, I've never seen it because it looks bad.
Welcome to the Punch?
Nope.
Seven Psychopaths.
I don't think it's fair to say I've forgotten that film. It's not one that I instantly go, oh, wow, yeah. It's good. I like that film.
It's not. Revolutionary Road.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's every time you say one that I have actually forgotten. I feel like there's a reason I've forgotten it, and I don't want to dig it up again, but I definitely feel better about that than Hacksaw Ridge.
Yeah,
Is it DiCaprio and Winslet?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Listen, let's not spill our beans over it yet, but I think that's
the one. Well, yeah. In which case, can I tell you something else? I'm delighted that my movie diary, which I sort of restarted this year, has finally come in handy because I forget, obviously the reason we're doing this podcast, I forget all films I've seen, so I've started to write them all down. You said Hercules 2014. I watched it on May the 9th of this year, and there's a couple of things down. I wrote down, would you do me the honour of listening to these for a moment?
Sure, it's off topic and off the premise of the podcast, but I'd love to hear what you have to say.
Thanks for agreeing to listen to my one interesting line here, Adam. Obviously Hercules, the most boring character in the film. At the end of the film, Ian McShane, who's in this film, playing Ian McShane, says, "You don't need to be a demigod to be a hero. You just need to believe you're a hero." And I thought that was so mental that I wrote it down. Because that's just... This is one of the stupidest things I've ever heard in a film.
But he is a demigod, isn't
well,
he?
Well, Hercules is, but forget about Hercules. You're at this point, Ian McShane is addressing the audience as the narrator of this film, and he's telling them what you've just seen here is the Rock. You don't need to be the Rock to be a hero. You just need to believe that you're a hero. Yeah, isn't that what like every? Not every mass murderer, but isn't that what everyone who...
every Christian believes. Every Christian.
Every Christian thinks.
Every mass murderer.
No, again, I'd like to say I do support the rights of individuals to their religion.